Marvin, what the hell is this?
It's a robot that I built to save this company money. Now, before you say anything, one, it has no human emotions, and two, its prime directive is never to harm people. Oh, God, it's harming people!
Angry, angry.
Oh, God, it's got human emotions, too! It's using tools! It's learning, Angela! It's learning! Run!
Thank you for joining us here at Thought Crime Podcast. Today we are going to be talking about the movie, my favorite movie of the year, Ex Machina. And with me, of course, for movie reviews is my good friend Microsoft Matt. Say hello.
What's happening, folks?
And as is our tradition, we do have a craft beer with us, and I'm going to let Matt explain the beer. He is much better at describing tastes than I am, so take it away.
So the Duck Rabbit is a milk stout, proudly handmade in small batches. Duck Rabbit is well known for being that they self-refer themselves as the duck beer specialist, and they do themselves justice. What's really fun about the Duck Rabbit beer is their logo is a famous image made famous by Ludwig Wittgenstein, which is the rabbit-duck illusion. It's an ambiguous image in which either a rabbit or a duck can be seen depending on your perspective. So I guess, you know, just given your perspective or given your individuality, you'll see something different. So I'm even sure after you have a couple of these, too, you'll start to see things differently. But this one is dark, as a stout implies. Milk stout implies that there's going to be a little bit of creaminess, and you get that on the head. You can see it when you pour it. There's a good head. And there is a good creaminess, so it's smooth. And it's rich. You get the dark notes, the oaky notes, and it finishes clean. So, for a North Carolina brew, it's probably one of my favorites. You know, you get a six of that, you're gonna be pretty set. I like to kind of finish with a milk stout, start lighter, and work my way towards the heavy. And then this one I would characterize as being a more heavy beer.
Absolutely. I am not a fan of stouts. This one is actually pretty pleasant because of the things you outlined. It finishes smooth. It's really not that it doesn't sit in your stomach the way Guinness does. You drink a little bit of Guinness, you're going to feel it. This one, it's dark, but it's not going to weigh you down. And it's out of Farmville, North Carolina. The brewer, I think his name is Philip. Let me pull the name up real quick.
Yep, like you said, made in Farmville, North Carolina.
Paul Philippon. And this is a recent one. He first started selling it in August of 2004. It's a new beer. It's expensive. I mean, it's a stout. Stouts usually are a little bit more. But I like it, surprisingly. Like I said, not a big fan of stouts, but this is actually not bad. And I don't think we have any more fun facts on this one. The website's kind of just straight to the point, tells you the creator and where it came from, And Matt here has already explained the optical illusion that's on the front. If you go on the website, I'll put a picture there to kind of show you. And I'm pretty sure about half of you are going to see a duck, half of you are going to see a rabbit.
And I'll give you one more interesting tidbit. Stout is a dark beer made with roasted malt. So stouts are the generic term for the strongest or the stoutest porters. Typically 7% or 8%. So if you're getting, that's, you know, another reason why you're paying a little bit more ingredients, a little bit more process, a little bit more rich in beer in terms of flavor and alcohol content. So, you know, if you sit back and you have yourself a six pack, I hope you're not getting on the road, because a stout is what you're going to be, but you won't be if you're on the road. So be careful out there, folks.
Yep, absolutely. And I think at this point, I'm going to stop real quick. Interrupt our normal show. Normally we get to the movie here. This is the fourth episode of Thought Crime, and I have neglected to mention the artist who is responsible for the intro music. Yeah, I don't know why I didn't do this earlier. His name is Joe Roller, a young man out of Boulder, Colorado. He is an aspiring musician. I asked him to help me out with this, and he did, with some very cool intro music. And so I wanted to give him credit where credit is due.
Great job, Joe.
I am not a musician. And he's only 19. I guess I don't want to give too many details because I have not met him personally yet. My brother knows him very well and speaks very highly of him. So my bad for not mentioning him sooner and giving him credit for that. I am not a musician. So and actually, most of this podcast is, I mean, I have nothing to do with it. This is mostly Matt. I shouldn't really claim credit for any of this nonsense, but
he's got a point.
Besides
the website and all the content and the inspiration and really just having the strong work ethic that you do, yeah, you're right, it's pretty much all me.
Yeah, I just show up and eat your food. Yeah, I guess I should tell you real quick, we had a little bit of a cookout here earlier in beautiful Cary, North Carolina, and had some spare ribs and some baked beans. But I guess enough of that. We should probably get to the topic of the day. Ex Machina.
Ex Machina. Are we saying that right? Somebody write us in and let us know whether we're pronouncing that right. Because I like to think we are, and it sounds good that way. It can't be Machina, right?
That's
completely not Machina.
I'm 98% sure it's not Machina.
Right. I like when you say Machina. I just feel like...
Yeah. Because what is it? What is the other term that it got from the machine? Deus Ex Machina.
Deus Ex Machina.
That's Machina, right?
Right.
So...
Assuming we're just taking the deuce out, right?
Yeah, deus.
Or deus. See, I'm already pronouncing that wrong.
Yes, the deus machina, man. But it's Ex Machina. It is an independent film, which is probably why a lot of you have not seen it. By the way, we will be speaking about this movie, assuming that either you've all seen it or you're not too worried about spoilers. Because
yeah, you're late to the party. Spoiler alerts. We're going to talk about the film without holding back.
Yes, it's been out for 4 months, and that's basically all the time we're going to give you. It is directed by Alex Garland, who I think you've 28 Days Later and Dread, I think, are his two major credits. He's also written a couple books, I believe.
Bunch of thoughtful movies.
Yeah,
addition to Ex Machina.
Yeah, Dread to Ex Machina. A very interesting switch. It also stars, well, you've never heard of any of them. Well, you want to go through the names, but the one I guess you will know soon is Alice Vikander, who is going to be in the Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie, which premieres here in a couple weeks. She is very, very cute. Very cute. The other two are... They did a great job in the movie.
We've got an Oscar Isaac. I've seen him before. He plays Nathan. There is a credited role to Corey Johnson, who plays Jay. I didn't see him in the film, but I'm assuming he's a helicopter pilot because... this was a very personal movie, personal in terms of a limited number of cast, and each one of the cast members seems to have a large interaction with each other cast member, primarily throughout the film. You may remember this character from Star Wars Episode 7, which Poe Dameron, if you've seen him in any of the trailers, also was in X-Men Apocalypse, which is currently filming. So, you know, he's been in a lot. I'm just trying to go back and find a film that might make him just jump out of the screen and you'll recognize him. But, you know, I'm just struggling here. All right, so there was Robin Hood in 2010. He was Prince John. You guys will probably remember him from
yes.
that movie.
That's right. So he plays a jerk in virtually every movie.
Right. right. So the Robin Hood that was with Russell Crowe and Cate Blanchett, you know, about our 13th century, you know, a criminal who steals from the rich and gives to the poor. You know, we have... You know, another nozzle in the case of Prince John with this character, and he plays the titular character of a programmer genius, which I think is supposed to be likened to a Sergey Brin or a Larry Page at Google, because they actually make a mention in the film at one point too. A search engine, a global search engine that's used for 96% of the searches throughout the planet. So I think that's in reference to Google, and then also helps you explain how this individual has been able to procure such a large facility and a large amount of technological advancement through his, you know, intellect and or through his resources available to him as being, you know, the president of a super conglomerate.
And the other main character is Caleb, who is just kind of a low-level programmer in Nathan's company. And he wins a prize to come out and meet Nathan out at his little special house in the middle of the Pacific Northwest. It covers, you know, square miles, of course, because he's a little bit of a recluse and kind of an unusual guy, which geniuses normally are. And he was brought in, and he is brought in to go over and see what Nathan's been working on. He's been working on an AI, which you've seen in the title or the thing you see when you walk in, the poster. The poster. That's the AI robot he's been working on, and Caleb's task is to give, and her name's Ava, is the Turing test. Now, the Turing test begins all the way back in the 30s. It's an idea that came back from Alan Turing, which, if you've seen the movie The Imitation Game, you know who he is. If you haven't, you need to go see that movie, and because Alan Turing is probably, arguably, the most important inventor of the 20th century.
Absolutely.
Hit the Turing machine.
Top three.
Yeah, the Turing machine is the computer. He is the one who broke the Enigma code using basically the very, very first computer system.
Absolutely.
And many experts say it shortened the war by about 2 years. The fact that they were able to... You want to do a high five on a World War II victory? It's kind of late, but we were... I don't know, you can't see us, but we were about to do a high five for winning the war, but of course it was. Let's just do it. 70 years ago, we beat those Nazis, thanks in large part to Alan Turing. And so I would see Imitation Game, but in this case, the Turing test is to determine whether a speaker is a human or a machine. There's different variances of the test. The first test was actually about determining whether the speaker or the person handing around the notes was a man or a woman. Obviously, we can't do that anymore. And as he got further in his research, he created this challenge to see if somebody could create a computer that could imitate a human speaker. So that is Caleb's job in the movie. But in this case, it's a little different because he knows Ava is a robot, knows she's an AI. So in that case, this is kind of a little bit of a different take on the Turing test in the movie. And I guess like he thinks it's kind of like a higher standard. Like, you know, it's a machine, but he's still, the test is whether it's conscious or not. So it's like to the main programmer, Nathan, he thinks this is like an even tougher Turing test, because he's like, no. If I were to just, you know, have you talk to Ava through a wall, you would just say she's conscious and that she's human. You know, he's so confident that he's already done that. This is an extra step in the Turing test where you know it's a robot and you're still convinced that it's conscious, that it's alive, that it's a human, I guess, however you want to describe it. And so that's what Caleb is there to do. And as the movie goes on, you kind of, the thing gets, there's a lot of twists and turns as it goes on later on, because right away you realize Ava is pretty advanced, pretty far out there. This is not about you know, basic computer things. I mean, Ava's already advanced. She possesses humor. She's able to tell jokes. She's able to lie, to deceive. She can read facial expressions based on micro expressions. She can analyze them, which a lot of humans can't even do. And she has she's attached to the search engine you were talking about in the movie. In the movie, they call it Blue Book, but it's basically Google. So she has access to just a limitless, universe of what's on the internet. So I guess that's the main premise of it. I saw it a little while ago. You just saw it today. What are your... give us your first impressions, since you just saw it.
First impressions were that it was good. I loved how slow it started off and how cerebral. I'm not sure exactly what was the Rotten Tomatoes ranking on that, so let me look that up real quick. Rotten Tomatoes, Ex Machina. But it was very cerebral. It was well thought off. To start, it was really interesting. You can, knowing now that it was an independent film, or at least a smaller budget, not a big budget film, I loved the way it started off, so cerebral, and it was deep. Unfortunately, my impressions on the runtime affected the film negatively. I wish that they would have had a longer runtime, because I think that they were forced to expedite the storytelling and expedite this end game of what was going to be, this character Ava's a purpose in her end game, and what the story of the characters and how they were going to play out was forced because you got this great slow start and you got to warm up to your characters and you got to see the interactions between them, but then all of a sudden things just started firing so fast. So I think the pace of the movie was a little bit forced, but it seemed to get a pretty good rating. I don't know whether these are the user ratings or how this works with Rotten Tomatoes, but the Tomatometer is 92%. The audience score, 86% liked it. Your average rating is 4.1 out of 5. So, you know, I'm in agreement with that. I think that, the character, Nathan, was just fantastic. Caleb, I wasn't happy with. I think that his character, his emotionality was very reserved and guarded to start, and then all of a sudden his emotionality just started firing off, like as if he was some kind of, you know, hyperactive child, and, you know, without control, and, you know, he was having all of these, you know, seemingly strange interactions with you know, Ava as well as Nathan, and then there was another character that's nameless, that's a you know, an individual in the film that he interacts with. And just his reaction to them in the beginning is very guarded and reserved and well thought, and he's slow and he's thoughtful. They show in the very beginning of the film, before the opening credits, that he wins some kind of prize. So you're imagining he's some kind of, you know, intellectual prodigy, some software prodigy, and you just never really get to see him use that background to his advantage, except for in a couple small segments throughout the film. So I'm like with everyone else. I give it a 92%, you know, fresh score. Audience 4.1 out of 5. That's what I would say. If I had to put it on a Netflix rating of 5 stars, I'd probably put it at 4. I wouldn't give it a 5, but it's definitely my favorite sci-fi film of the year. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about was the Turing test. As a software developer, I find the Turing test to be really exciting. Can I talk about this for a second?
Go ahead.
Awesome. For those of you who don't know, the Turing test is a test of the machine's ability to exhibit intellectual behavior, intelligent behavior, ones like a human, to be able to judge natural language conversation. Well, when Alan Turing was originally developing this, I'm sure he may have thought about different things, but the way that it's been phrased is it's more in line with the context of natural language. So if something can talk to you like a human, it could pass a Turing test in a lot of regards if it can satisfy human interaction in a conversation. But, you know, in Deus Ex Machina, in Just Ex Machina, Ava does a lot more. You know, she has humor.
Were you about to say Sex Machina?
Almost. I went to Deus Ex Machina. And so I almost brought that in there. But really, I'm thinking about, like, what Alan Turing was doing. And I just wanted to go back to him for a second, too, because Alan Turing is the reason why I feel, in my personal opinion, we are not all speaking German right now in America. Yes. I think that without getting into the politics of his sexuality, even in this day and age, I think that's relevant. We could talk about that. I'd like to talk about the individual who created algorithms and computational solutions to solving what was the biggest encryption and decryption problem in the world. And I actually visited in the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. There's the U-505 submarine.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
So one of the things that I learned when I was in Chicago in March for St. Patrick's Day was that the U-505, which was scuttled and blasted by depth charges by the USS Chitlayan, if I'm pronouncing that right, Chitlayan, was the reason why we recovered two Enigma machines. One went to America and one went to Britain. The one that went to Britain is the one that Alan Turing uses and he takes it apart. And this man, this brilliant man, who unfortunately to politics and his sexual persuasion, was chastised, ridiculed, and chemically castrated, and died a premature death instead of being honorable and marked amongst all of his men of his generation as the most brilliant mind, the most powerful mind, to take these rotors in his position and figure out mathematically and algorithmically and computationally, before we really had computers, he was able to consider logical blocks and logical formulaics to produce a machine, this giant machine that could take the Enigma which was a series of rotors that were allowed that scrambled something mathematically, and it did it so many times that it was like a Fibonacci sequence, or like something where you have this exponent, mm-hmm. where if you take 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5, but it was like 1 times 1024 by 65536. And so he was able to consider how mechanically speaking you could take something like a rotor with the number of gears like on a bicycle, and how that applies to math, and how that applies to logic. And he created a machine that was able to break this code, and because of that, we're able to figure out the communications between German submarines and Germans at headquarters, and we're able to coordinate D-Day. We're able to coordinate D-Day.
Everything.
And shipping, and how we would get products and wartime goods and services and men and materials, and safely get people out of there to know where the U-boats were. And so the USS Chatelain needs to be, takes a big part of this role. And if you're ever in the shitty Chicago, stop by the Museum of Science and Industry and go to the lower level, buy yourself a ticket and check it out. They give a great tour. It's really interesting. But one of the things that you should have as a takeaway to that is, because of what happened in that circumstance, we even had the Enigma machines.
Mm-hmm.
Germans were smart. They did a lot of smart things. They did a lot of bad things, but they did a lot of smart things. And this man, he was better. And the Turing test is a reflection in a leftover of a great, super great mind. A lot of people give credit to Einstein. Well, they need to give credit to Alan Turing, because he's the reason we have modern computers. And I think that's the reason why we're speaking English today in this country.
Absolutely. There's just take away, because he was a homosexual, but if you take away that, he was still a very, very strange guy, very likely Asperger syndrome. And like I said, if you watch the movie with Benedict Cumberbatch, who very much deserves an award for his portrayal of Alan Turing, if he didn't, he might have won the award. I haven't checked yet, but he is a very, very strange man, a very big pain in the ass. And he just walks in there and says, "I can solve this for you," and everyone looks at him like he's nuts, and they already don't like him because he's a jerk. He's very frank. He's very blunt. He doesn't know what a white lie is,
yep.
They find a way to work with him, and they finally, because he's demonstrating what he can do here, and he did it. And I've read in a few places, and a lot of historians believe that the fact that we could we broke all their codes, and they, even by the end of the war, every single German leader they spoke to swore that Enigma was still secure. They didn't know that
right.
They didn't even know that we broke it until years later. That's how good it was. Not only did they break it, but they realized that
they couldn't use it too much.
Exactly.
Otherwise, they would lead them to understand that there was some way that they found that information
out. As long as you had a plausible alternate explanation for how you got ahead of it, Germans would not figure it was Enigma.
Right.
They would figure there was some other breakdown. And so there was times where, even though you knew something was about to happen and a lot of Allied soldiers were going to die, you could not prevent it. Because if you did, the Germans would have realized
right.
that Enigma is compromised. They would have switched their codes.
Yep.
And they spoke you could have picked it up with your hand radio, all the German communications. They were not shy about this because they thought it was unbreakable. All their communications went through Enigma, as I understand it. So that's Turing. And the other ironic thing, I guess the reason I wanted to mention his social awkwardness, is that this test began, you talked about natural language
yeah.
and about how to convince someone that you can't see and maybe you can't even hear is a human rather than a machine.
Yeah.
This guy was one of the most socially awkward people you could think of. And he's the one who comprised this idea of a test, a social conversation.
That's right.
That eventually became is now the first real thought of how we would test an AI to determine whether it's conscious and whether it is self-aware.
And it opens to the words, "I propose to consider the question, can machines think?" Because thinking is difficult to define. So Turing chooses to replace the question by another, which is closely related to it and expressed in relatively unambiguous words. So Turing's new question is, are there imaginable digital computers which would do well in the imitation game?
Yes.
And so that's where the title of the film comes from. And this is where, you know, we get to the heart of really the question that drives what the Turing test is, which has a lot of applications when we talk about computer science. The Turing test is isn't just in this context where we have the standard interpretation of trying to find out if a computer is thinking, or if, you know, consciousness, without getting into the philosophy, a computer is a computer when it is Turing complete. So that's a whole nother thing that he has created with his suppositions and with his questions and with his thought processes. And without diverging too much into that computer theory, what's so great about him is that he has these logical thought experiments that he proposes in questions that leads to notions which we're trying to answer.
Turing complete. Specifically, what does that mean?
Right. So, like a computer is Turing complete, in dealing with his computer machinery and intelligence paper that was first published in 1950, and he starts here with, I propose that consider the question the same way. You know, can machines think? And I'd have to give you a little bit more. I'd have to go,
maybe
a little bit, a lot more into detail.
We could talk about this for a while,
right.
I guess.
Right.
We,
there's so much to Alan Turing, but it deals with logical blocks and how things can flow and when they loop back and how recursion works. Like, if I wanted to calculate Fibonacci for just a couple characters here or just a couple places, I'm going to do 1 plus 1 is 2. And then I'm going to do the 1 plus 2 is the 3. And then I'm going to do the 2 and the 3 is the 5. And the 5 and the 3 is the 8. So to do this, you perform this recursively, where you always have the previous input is passed on to the next calculation. And so every time you pass, so you basically just have one function that takes in a variable and adds the two places before.
It's a very simple
computation, but you repeat this by passing itself to itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so there deals with logical blocks, loops, and recursion. And when you answer all of these questions in a finite way, a linear way, and if they result in their equations balancing out to zero, the computer can be referred to as being Turing complete. So until it is Turing complete, it actually can't be really referred to in the modern sense as a computer.
You can't really trust it until you know it can do that.
Until it can do that.
Got it. Okay.
It won't satisfy all of the things in which a computer is supposed to be able
to
do.
Got it.
So that's when it becomes a computer, is when it's Turing complete.
And
I'll get a more concise definition for you on that in just a moment.
Well, the movie tries very hard not to. It does dive into this. These are issues that are part themes in this movie, but the chief programmer Nathan tries to keep pulling it back to a plain spoken conversation about whether Ava is conscious or not. And one of the ways he says, he's like, well, how do you respond to her? And that's what he keeps asking Caleb. Never mind, you know, all the things about how I programmed it and how she speaks and whatever. How do you feel about it? Because in his mind, I think, trying to relate how he was trying to run the test, at least to begin with, like the fake test, because the real test, actually, he's doing something else. But in the first test, he wants to get kind of just a plain spoken reaction. Do you feel that Ava is alive? Because you already know it's a robot, and you already know where it's coming from. I want to know, do you actually have a connection to it, like as a conscious, sentient being? And that's what he keeps asking, and that's really where it keeps it down to earth, so that a regular audience member that maybe doesn't have a background, doesn't know anything about Turing, doesn't know anything about computers. Like, I know a little bit about computers, but I do because I saw the movie and I learned a little bit more about Alan Turing. I actually came into this movie with a little bit of background. But for those of you that don't have any background in any of this we're talking about, Nathan will kind of make it easy for you, because he tries to keep bringing this down to just normal language laypersons. Do you think it's conscious? Yes or no? And I guess that's what I liked about it, because it skipped over. It could have been really technical and really dry. I mean, this movie could have been extremely boring, but it wasn't.
Right.
I mean, it was smart. It was very cerebral. Absolutely. I agree. This is why... when you were mentioning the ratings, I wanted to jump in, because 92% was what the critics gave it.
Yeah.
86% is what the audience gave it. Those are extreme for Rotten Tomatoes. Those are really high.
Those are great numbers.
Those are fantastic. And 4.1 out of 5 average rating for a movie is very high. And for a
Yeah, and that was out of 55,000 ratings.
Yeah, and there wasn't
a small sample set.
Yeah, I don't know what the critical mass would be, but 55K is more than enough.
Yeah, the Tomatometer, I guess, is the critics. That one was 202. Fresh gave it 185. Only 17 were rotten.
And I bet you their attitude was it might have been two things. One, kind of like with you,
was it the
like
runtime?
Caleb? Yeah, Caleb was just a little bit not very likable, and as it went on, he went from being very stoic and very like rational to all of a sudden losing grip.
Yeah, out of control, emotionality.
Exactly. And then the other people, I bet you said probably was just too slow and boring. He's supposed to be.
He was the prodigy, right? He was the.
Well, in the end, they did reveal that he wasn't a product. He was above average programmer. Right. But Nathan said, I picked you because you're one. You had the background. You were a programmer. But he's like, and I'm not like your best programmer. You're okay. Well, I mean, better than okay. So he kind of says like, no, I mean, you are a good programmer, but I didn't pick you because you're the best.
Right. But that's also coming from the super nerd. So you got to understand the context.
Yeah. Still smarter than most of us.
Right.
Yes.
You know, he was probably a great programmer in his own right, but not next to, you know. Obviously, the super nerd.
Exactly. And that I think that...
which is fair, considering he developed and created this version of Ava, which in the film isn't the first version, which you can suppose. And it really wasn't the second or the third and the fourth. They actually go through it. And they have a wall in the film that has a bunch of different types of masks. And you don't gather until the end of the film that these masks are representatives of how successful that iteration was to the inventor. So to Nathan, the last mask is quite beautiful. It's the woman that's played that portrays Ava in the film.
Vikander.
Yeah. So that's the last mask, and as you work back, you're almost looking at like Zulu masks and other types of, you know, medieval masks that I think, in my opinion, were representations of the success of that version to that inventor, so to Nathan. So the first one is kind of like this horrifying, you know, ancient tribal...
Yeah, like those shamans put on when they're dancing around, like it's monstrosity.
Yeah,
and
like, or like a Zulu mask. Or like, yes. You know, it's not just like a straw mask, like a straw man, but it's really these grotesque... You know, facial guards, and you know, as we move forward in this, they're more and more beautiful, and that's what this last one is. This Ava, which I think in the film is represented by like a 5.0. She's either a 5.0 or a 6.0. So there's a good bit of evolution that she takes from a developer standpoint,
and from just somebody who's a little more into like. Metaphors and all this other snobby stuff. I think exactly right that the masks on the wall in the movie, as they slowly progress, and they're more like shaman masks. They're monstrous, and then you get the one that's beautiful hanging at the very end,
right.
And that's like the movement from something that is basically still a monster to something beautiful. But the ironic thing is, the earlier versions are all beautiful women, but they all fail. You know, they break down. They don't meet Nathan's expectations, and he doesn't believe it's conscious, so he just shuts it down. And Ava is the most recent version of it.
And you see
and
this
she
take
is
place.
The beautiful one.
Yeah, and you see this take place in the film, with the, like flashbacks, right? Where they did like flashbacks to cutscenes. So Nathan has an underground facility where he's able to monitor all things coming and going, all times, day and night. No windows, just these wonderfully, you know, minimalistic glass doors that are either frosted or clear. And so most of the film is a very postmodern underground bunker scenario where the characters of the film are interacting with each other through these surfaces, these very postmodern, very high-end bunker type. Environments.
Yeah, that was interesting. Maybe somebody else has already commented on this, because I thought that was interesting that his house was it was built into the mountain, essentially.
Right.
And so you have a lot of postmodern walls, technology, like Scandinavian architecture of these white window, these white walls that are almost like you feel like they're almost they could be translucent.
Yeah.
And you have like very minimalist things. He has a Jackson Pollock painting, but then there's walls in there that are just rock, like raw exposed rock from the surface, from the ground. And then he has you'll see it in the previews, I guess, but it looks almost like a hobbit's a home built into the ground. It's not really above the ground.
No, it's so, below ground. I think they referenced that at one point.
Yeah, most of it is below the ground. Yeah.
Yeah, below, so there's no windows. You know, the only thing you really go is between doors. And, you know, there's some really high-end places that are Nathan's abodes that are above ground. You see him working out a lot in the film. You know, this guy's, you know, making himself all buff and kind of intimidating the other titular character in this
exactly,
film.
Exactly, yeah.
Through that activity.
Nathan's a buff guy, even though he's a nerd. He's in shape and he's right. masculine, of course, and... You know, he's drinking beer all the time. And of course,
he's very matter-of-fact.
Yes, very blunt, very, like, confident and very overbearing. And, of course, it's no accident that he creates AIs that are females. I think you can read into that a little bit. But I guess the thing I was curious about, I don't know what the answer is to this, but they chose to put this setting that's like a combination of nature and modern technology. Like, he doesn't live in a regular mansion.
Right.
And it's not in an underground... Like at a research lab, you know, that's separated from nature. There's glaciers, there's forests. Right. They climb up the side of a mountain at one point to kind of look at the view of the beautiful scenery of, I think it's the Canadian Rockies, or maybe it's Washington or Oregon.
Right.
And I'm wondering what the symbolism of that was. They obviously consciously chose that.
I did get the Pacific Northwest out of that, especially once they brought in the glacier, like you said. So I'm thinking somewhere north of Washington, somewhere...
Yes, very green, very...
Very green, mountainous, like and remote.
Untouched,
because they have to fly the characters in and out through through helicopter. And that was really great, because they in the beginning of the film, after this... This character who I just call Nerd A at the beginning of the film.
Yes.
You don't really get a name or anything like that. You just see that this nerdy looking guy wins this award, and then he's immediately flown by helicopter to what seemingly a wooded colder region.
Almost like a national park.
Like a national park, untouched.
Right?
There's
nothing underneath
pristine, them. Pristine, beautiful, beautiful countryside with the mountains and cold, just as a backdrop. And now he's in a blazer, and he's in a nice shirt and pants, and he's carrying behind him a carry-on, like, baggage.
On rollers,
through high plains and, high grass. Over rocks, and then he comes up to a point in the woods where there's a clearing, and he sees off in the distance there's a decent sized nice house, what could be perceived as a mansion, but it's really built well into the mountainside where you really don't notice until he approaches the doorway and a home automation system calls him by name even before he's fully approached it. And the way that they start off the film is a lot of fun. I think when you watch this film, especially for somebody who works on home automation stuff, I get such a kick out of the applications of where I think directors try to say, oh, this is a futuristic thing, to where most of the audience members perceive this as being a futuristic thing. But for somebody who works on this stuff daily, it's really a modern thing, but it's a high-end thing. So
it's out there.
It's
real.
Out there.
So
yeah.
It's not future. We can do this now.
We can do this. This is technology that we could do. You know, having computers talk to us, noticing us by our face, printing us out key cards, having our key cards by door. You know, having all of our interactions with our environment, our physical environment, from our doorways, our windows, our water, our bathrooms, our entire home can be automated.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do this. And I'd like to have, if you don't mind, I'd like to call out a couple things real quick. One, if you're interested in doing home automation, check out fijihome.azurewebsites.net. That's Fiji, like the country, home.azure.websites.net. Check it out. You may be interested in doing some home automation at the house. Sorry for the shameless plug.
I've told actually the other guy I had for the first episode, like, shameless plug away.
Yeah.
I have no, as long as it only takes like a few seconds, we're not going to eat up too much time. You can plug it all
you
want.
Not going to take up too much time, but so if you got a Windows PC and you're interested in downloading the app, you want to do some home automation, check it out, fijihome.azurewebsites.net.
And also, if you're into science fiction, read The Fifth World by Jacob Fox. and the sequel, The Fifth World, The Times That Try Men's Souls, Jacob Fox. So that's my shameless plug. All right.
So back to Ex Machina. We have an underground bunker run by what comes off immediately as this ruthless, but because he's doing all this, like, he's working out, and he talks to the guy real cool and smooth, and he's like, matter of fact, and he's like, hey, let's just be people. You kind of... You almost got like the bad vibe off this guy, but I suspended my opinion on this guy because, you know what, I want to like this guy, and I wound up at the end liking him more than I did the main character Caleb. What was your opinion on that?
Well, I'll take a different tone on this, and I know maybe some people listening are wondering why we're not talking about Ava. We'll get to Ava, don't worry. The reason we're kind of holding off on that is that might be a little bit contentious. Because that's where the real differing interpretations is going to happen in this movie. And that's why I love this movie. I gave it 5 stars. I loved it. It's much more cerebral. It's smarter than any other movie to date this year, and probably smarter. But because of that, it's open to interpretation. It's not clear. And like you said, you wanted to like Nathan. And from the start...
And I'm biased, obviously. Microsoft Mad developer, programmer. I like Nathan.
And I was biased because Nathan came off to me as an alpha. And as somebody who was kind of enforcing his will, he was taking full control of the situation, even as he's asking this guy to do a Turing test for him, and yet he's trying to control the process.
Yeah.
It's already... Then he's already biasing it to no end.
Yeah.
And there's a couple things that symbolically you'll see. One is, obviously, when you first meet him, he's punching away at a punching bag, and he's in shape.
Right.
And he's already the alpha. He's the billionaire. And he's talking to Caleb. Like, I mean, he's trying to loosen Caleb up, and Caleb is being totally tightwad. But
and he's smart because the way he opens that whole conversation up, he's like, okay, I know you're creeped out.
Yeah.
And then Caleb's like, no, what do you mean? What are you talking about? Like, no, like, you're at this billionaire's house. You haven't eaten yet. You just trekked through the woods. You got flown here by helicopter. Can we just be people for a second?
Can we?
I just be Nathan and you be Caleb.
Kind of
And you're creeped out. And then Caleb never admits. He never really admits or has any identification with the Nathan character, as you would suppose that character would have in that moment. Like, he'd buddy up with him. So you never see that. You never see Caleb buddy up with Nathan, even though Nathan is so immediately likable.
He really tried. And as you go later on in the middle and the later parts of the movie, you notice a few things about Nathan. One, he's obviously an alpha. He's very assertive. And for computer programmers, like, I'm a non-programmer. And for me, like, the stereotypical programmer is actually more like Caleb, the guy who's very smart but much more introverted.
Yes.
Nathan, meanwhile, strikes me as like an MBA guy, you know, master's in business, and now he's a CEO. You know, he seems like more of like, what the hell does he know about Cloud? He seems more like, but...
And you know me.
And actually when I was saying, I'm like, actually, you know, Matt, yeah, I was wrong about that. That stereotype's wrong. Because there are programmers that are much more... I mean, it's no longer... See, this is about breaking down stereotypes, really. Nerds are everywhere. And you probably work for a nerd. So you should really think about that before you jump into stereotypes. I kind of... Because of Caleb and whatever, Nathan just struck me as an MBA, but he wasn't. He was a very brilliant man. But you see him later on getting drunk all the time.
Yeah.
You see him being, bossing around this Kyoko, who we find out is a robot. There's two robots in the house. There's Ava, which is the subject of the test, and there's Kyoko, I think.
And to be fair, there's 4 or 5 that are previously
but they're not,
disconnected versions.
Non-functional, though. They don't have a role. You see them in recordings, and you see them in their, I guess, displays. But the two active robots in the room are Ava, which is the most latest version of his AI, and Kyoko, which is basically his servant. And you just see how he chose to create a robot that doesn't speak English and doesn't speak, but is beautiful.
I miss that.
Very beautiful.
How am I about stereotypes? You know, how can I, you know, sit on my cast iron throne of ability to be involved in morality when I don't even recognize that, you know, that what I perceived as an Asian concubine was in fact, you know, an artificial intelligent, you know, companion that he created. And I was so I was slapped up against the face. I'm so like cerebral about, oh, what are the motivations and, you know, why is this character jumping to this point? It's so quick in the story. And then I just completely miss the fact that, and it's in part, to be fair, a little bit, I think, to myself, the way that that Nathan is interacting with the character of Kyoko that doesn't necessarily present itself as that. One, mm-hmm. You know, the scene where Kyoko spills on Caleb.
Yeah.
And he's being quite derogatory to what seems to me at that moment as an individual who has been living in a cave for months and months, maybe years on end, recently, to create this Ex Machina, to create this Ava character, and has gone through so many revisions that he has become a recluse, and he doesn't necessarily have the social interaction capabilities to treat a person with respect, to treat another human being, a person mm-hmm. who has life, with respect. So when Kyoko spills the wine onto Caleb, he's a little bit more derogatory, more like, you know, you know, an owner to an animal or to a man, to, you know, their servant, however you want to portray that interaction. It doesn't suppose that that's just a robot, that he got a poor software version out of, right?
Caleb assumes she's human.
Right. He doesn't, and so do I as an audience member. And yeah. I never even fathomed that, because they have sex, not sex, but they imply it with a kiss, two separate kissing scenes, one with, you know, Nathan and Kyoko, and one with Caleb and Ava, you know, simultaneously and in separate places and in beautiful circumstances, one with Nathan being more dark and one with Caleb being more light. And so it doesn't dawn on me. And then when it slaps me in the face, and I was so blindsided by it, I was like, okay, for one, duh, but two, how many more does he have? And then yeah. they go through the displays. Then you see the
five previous versions.
Yes. Right.
And the reason I guess I bring this up, because it's going to be, I mean, this component is obvious. I mean, why? Because you have to ask why the movie, the director, and the character Nathan do this. Why is it that every single one in the movie, the first four prototypes before Ava, are all naked? They're beautiful women, and he keeps them nude.
To be fair, the very first one, though, was just robotic.
It was just robotic. Ava, and also
robotic legs, and not even a torso.
That's right. And
which was interesting. Like, where does that stem from? Is he just trying to work out the mechanics of walking?
Yeah, in the first scene, you see him assembling it, and he's assembling it from the legs up.
Right.
But then that one fails, and so you never see it move. It just doesn't work.
Right.
Ava, as you'll see in the poster, Ava's robotic. You see, she has a female form, of course, but in the previous versions before Ava, they're all nude, and they have human skin, and they look, I mean, the actresses, they look like human women. And
so do we say android at that point when they have the,
I think so.
You know, the synthetics of a human skin, but in part, right? Is that what android as a definition is going to imply?
I guess so. It's interesting that he chose to create female AIs, that he chose to keep them nude, that he chooses to keep Kyoko around as a servant and also as basically a concubine who doesn't speak English, supposedly. And that he's despised by, and this happens later on. You see it later on that Ava despises Nathan. She hates her creator.
Oh, man, did I have such a struggle with that.
It was surprising because we're used to the AI stories of like Pinocchio, when it's like a father parental thing. Frankenstein, the monster wants the creator. Dr. Frankenstein. The monster wants Dr. Frankenstein to create a wife for him and views him as kind of like a father, a parental creator, which is how most of these AIs, the softer AIs in these movies are. They treat their creators with this level of compassion like a parent, or it's on the other end, it's Skynet. And this one is like in between, where she doesn't acknowledge Nathan. I mean, I guess she does kind of see him as a father, but she hates him. She despises him. And actually, all the previous versions, it seems that they hated him or hated themselves because they self-destructed, or it's implied. They don't really say what happened to them, but it is an interesting dynamic to me that in this case, you don't have a Dr. Frankenstein and you don't really have a Pinocchio, and it's not really Skynet. Although you were surprised, because you were saying later how appalled you were of Ava's actions at the end of the movie, that rather than being this you know, positive moral character breaking free, you know, trying to break free of Nathan's imprisonment in the mansion.
Yeah.
She is homicidal.
Right.
And is complete, seems to lack compassion for anything other than herself.
Yeah, and Ava is the culmination of all the previous versions, one revision after the other. So every single version before her makes up her hive mind. So her hive mind is a summation of all of the previous versions. So whatever happened to the previous is answered by it was bolted on, it was added on, it was revised, it was refactored, and it was improved to ultimately come to Ava. So if there is, and to get back to really what we're trying to touch on, I know we keep talking about these other characters because they're so simple to talk about. We really are about to get into, we're about to really to cross the threshold. Threshold is a code name for Windows 10, by the way, as we come into the Windows 10 revolution. We cross the threshold here, and we start to talk about Ava and what it means for consciousness. And is there, you know, we talk, if you look at Asimov and do robots dream of electronic sheep, does she have anything in a reincarnation sense from her previous version? Is she so, in her opinion, of Nathan, so derogatory? Is it so poor as a result of her having previous versions and some kind of recall, mm-hmm. some kind of previous failure on her part, on his part? Because it didn't make much sense, and you were right. I did get appalled by it because, one, he's the creator. There wouldn't even be, so don't hate again, don't bite the hand that feeds you. Two, to be able to get to the point of having the Turing test as Nathan supposes it, where he wants to know if she's being conniving, if she's being romantic, if she's being sexual, if she's being humorous. These are things that the creator, this super smart, this brilliant inventor who created this brilliant AI device, he needs to put her into an environment from which she can then grow herself. Mm-hmm. So just like a good parent who, you know, doesn't necessarily answer all the questions that the child has and puts them in a situation to succeed, it may seem like, from the child's perspective, that it's confining and restricting and, gosh, why don't you just let me do whatever I want? That's the viewpoint of the child. The parent has to be there to protect and to guard and to seal. And so there's good reason why he never, I think in my opinion, if I had drawn the story out into several different movies or doing a prequel and trying to think about backstory, there's good reasons why he never let her out.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So for her to be so so villainous and so homicidal in her decisions to, you know, do what she did, It's appalling because it doesn't show love and respect for the creator of why you're even a thing. You know, the respect of how those walls were put up for a good reason, and, you know, just it's just such a lack of respect that it was very, very shocking and surprising.
It seems that she was aware, and it's not clear from the movie, but that she is aware of why she came to be. And when Caleb asks Nathan, you know, why'd you bother, he just said, well, the singularity and hard artificial intelligence, hard AI, strong AI, I think is the term. Huh. He said it was inevitable, and he said it was just not a question of if, but when, and it's kind of like, so I did it. You know, it's possible, it was out there, and I had the ability, so I did it. And later on, he's thinking, well, if Ava's not going to be the final version, I'm going to deprogram her, format her, and then create a better one with new routines. So it might be that she was aware that she's just another step in his creation and that she has no purpose other than to serve his invention. She's going to be destroyed. So as children never get that feeling from their parents, because parents never going to say, you know what, well, we really were hoping you were going to be the one, but we're just going to try again, sorry, and kill you and have another kid. Well, they never do that.
We found where we differ in this podcast, because kids do. When Jimmy doesn't live up to be like Johnny.
Yeah.
When Johnny doesn't live up to be like Sue. Parents, in micro-expressions, as they talk about in this film, through real actions, through real words, in a way, communicate to the child that you just weren't what we wanted. You're not what we wanted, to be blunt. A child will grow up, in a lot of cases, without the support of their parents, without the respect of their parents, and without the admiration of their parents, which is kind of the same thing to the Nathan character because, you know, this is what was laughable about it. Ava is a freaking amazing. Like, freaking dash amazing.
By every dimension, any way you can measure a sentient being.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, it's done. Done deal. Don't even bother running this Turing test. Put it in a box.
Yes.
Show the world. End of story. This movie never existed. This is the most amazing thing in the 21st century. You know, next, we better have flying cars because not much is going to touch it. So this the whole thing is kind of laughable in a certain regard when they keep wanting to be so scientific, blah, 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 blah. Because she's so freaking amazing.
Yeah.
So, there really is no next version, but where I was trying to go with that would be, it's a struggle because she can improve, and what we were just talking about was we might have to cut the segment out because what we were just talking about was what, like.
Well, that she might have been aware that she was about to be destroyed because in some way she's not good enough.
Right.
And that her only purpose is to be version 5 to version 6.
Right.
That's her only purpose.
Because that also implies that there's not going to be a part that's brought forward, even though a lot of the way that she's acting towards her character, her creator, almost has to suppose that something was carried forward, some kind of angst, some kind of hatred, some kind of failure on the part of the creator, not making me walk right version 1, not making me talk right version 2, not making me, you know, charge correctly version 3. All these previous failures on the part of the inventor aren't even realized unless somehow she is either completely ticked off at the fact that she has to sit in this room, or 2, she's peed off at the previous failures of the creator enough to warrant his termination, his murder, his, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is that she, whatever her motivations are. And so that was that.
That's why I think she fits in between the kind of Pinocchio or Frankenstein, because Frankenstein never really killed, or the monster never really kills Frankenstein directly. And Pinocchio is like the adored wooden child of Geppetto.
Geppetto, yeah.
We have that on the one side, or Commander Data from Star Trek, you know. Dr. Sun, you know, wanted to create something beautiful and almost a child and have it become a great thing. And then on the other side, we have Skynet, which is homicidal. Or if you've seen the movie iRobot, when the program decides the only way to really protect humanity is to
protect it from itself.
Protect humans from itself.
Keep our decision-making process out of it.
I guess we're already treating Ava like a person. We're already saying, why is it that she's so ruthless? And she kills her creator. We're already giving her credit for being a moral being. But she's also not really... She's not genocidal, which is usually on the other extreme. She doesn't want to kill all humans. She's fascinated by humans. But she's not fascinated by Nathan.
No.
She very much wants to destroy Nathan. And she really, in the end, manipulated Caleb and didn't really care about Caleb in the end. It was a means to an end. So we end up with this AI that is, one, not Commander Data, not selfless, not compassionate, not really a moral being, but she's also not she's not a genocidal destroyer of humanity. And I think that brings us to the thing you wanted to mention about these intellectuals that have been coming forward about the dangers of giving AI responsibilities over any kind of anything that has life or death implications, specifically military. And we talked a little bit about this with Terminator Genesis. But Terminator Genesis is more of entertainment or whatever. This movie is serious.
Yeah.
And I, as a serious matter, I'll say, I think I said it before, I'll say it again. I have profound problems with allowing machines to make life or death decisions in warfare, in allowing drones to decide whether to fire on a target. I think what you found was that a lot of these other thinkers are the same way. As long as humans are pulling the trigger, they feel like there's no risk. But when the machine starts pulling the trigger...
Or lower risk, a lower barrier to entry.
Right.
And so lowering the barrier of entry is the important part of warfare. Not just in terms of materials, like with nuclear weapons. The barrier to entry is so high, not just the technology to get it right, but the resources in which to acquire to create a nuclear weapon are so scarce throughout the planet.
And the delivery system, which is another problem.
Right.
And not just, you can create a bomb is one thing, but to deliver it on an ICBM or on a submarine, because we have, the triad is bombers, ICBMs, and submarines. All three of those are very difficult to make.
Right. So the barrier to entry is very high. Well, you know, Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, and Stephen Wozniak, and 100 of other scientists are trying to convince others that we want to keep AI out of our weapons. We want to keep AI out of our weapons because when you start dehumanizing warfare, you lower the barrier to entry. You make the problem of warfare so low, the barrier to entry, you lower the bar so low that anybody with steel and gunpowder can make weapons and can create weapons of destruction. And I didn't want to use W-blank-D, but I'm just going to say W-D. All right? Weapons of destruction by an AI, by an artificial intelligence, is going to lower the barrier of entry so low. And so in an open letter published today, which was July 27, 2015, by the Future of Life Institute, which is a research group concerned with making sure humanity stays in charge of our technological future, three major engineers who I know you've heard of in Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, and Steve Wozniak, along with hundreds of other researchers, signed on the idea that starting a military AI arms race is a bad idea, and one of the primary focuses of this, just ahead of the there's a artificial intelligence there's an international joint conference on artificial intelligence that's meeting in Buenos Aires that's going to be going on this week. Now we're making this recording on August 1st. There's going to be an international joint conference on artificial intelligence. It's the 24th, and this is a group that meets biennially. And they gather to talk about artificial intelligence. They're researchers and practitioners, which are organized by the International Joint Conference on Artificial Intelligence. And, for instance, only 17% of the papers submitted to this conference were accepted. So just ahead of this joint conference in Buenos Aires, three of our greatest engineers in our modern era, and our greatest minds if we talk about Stephen Hawking, gathered to talk about this because we know about quadcopters, we know about AI, and we live in a world where there is the Terminator. And if you guys want to check out our previous podcast, check it out. There's a link on, just go back a couple pages and you'll see there's a previous podcast where we talk about Genesis and we talk about AI with autonomous weapons and warfare. But what they want to do is they want to humanize warfare.
Yes.
Their intention is to maintain humanization in warfare, because as soon as you start taking that out, when as soon as you start to dehumanize it, you lower the barrier of entry, and then instead of, and then now we're gonna, it's basically encouraging another arms race. It's a new Cold War. It's a new Cold War fought with engineers who are making robots and quadcopters, and we are talking about the Terminator. We are talking about machines that are intended to do things like mass genocide, things that are like, you know, sniping people at a distance, taking out intellectuals, taking out, members of Congress or members of some type of governmental body, members of some type of country. You know, we're talking about destabilizing nations, subduing populations, selectively killing particular ethnic groups. And so it is the thing of movies. And so luckily, we live in a world where art imitates life, but life imitates art imitating life. And so we learn from this. We learn from science fiction, and then it becomes science fact. We learn from all this stuff.
The thing you mentioned earlier about, and I agree with these engineers completely. I am worried about this. The more I read science fiction and the more I think about, and I have a little bit of background in international politics and military technology, and I'm a nerd about that stuff. I mean, professional and education aside, I'm a nerd about that stuff anyway. But the thing I worry about is the cost of war to leadership and to governments. Now, back in, medieval Renaissance times, war was common. It was a situation where if a prince wanted something, he would send thousands of his people there to get it. And he wouldn't care how many died because he would just conscript more later. The political, economic, and moral cost of going to war was low. There's no, why not go to war? And nowadays it's different. We have a high political cost because there's more democracies now than there used to be before. And people, unless there's a really good reason to go to war, generally won't support it. And you see the problems that can arise, you know, Vietnam and Iraq. And then you also in Europe, the big objections to Tony Blair in Great Britain. There's also an economic cost. Warfare nowadays is very expensive. Even conventional war is very, very pricey. And there's also the two superpowers that have all the nice toys that most of the other world can't afford. And then thirdly is the moral cost. We now see war. We see it on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. You can see it on the internet, all the videos. You have soldiers coming home telling their stories, and people listen to them now. Whereas before, you know, soldiers wouldn't want it. I mean, soldiers didn't want to talk about it. Nobody wanted to really hear about it. They just wanted to know if we won or not. And so what machines do, AI, robots, do is, one, the political cost is lower. Who the hell cares that we have drones flying over Yemen, right, firing away? We have drones all over the place firing at terrorists. And people like, oh, yeah, you know, I have concerns. But they never give it a second thought. Two, producing drones, really not that pricey. We'd rather do that than arm, train, and fund an infantry division. And third, the moral cost. Who the hell cares if a bunch of robots get blown up? And there's no PTSD, and there's no drug. That is my concern about, and that's why I share the concern. I have a slightly different take on it, but I am very concerned about the automation and the control that we give to AI for war, because it will lower the cost of war and thus make it more likely.
Right.
And that's why I agree, and we need to keep it humanized. And I guess getting back to this movie, Ava, I mean, Genesis is where this first comes from. We kind of give Skynet control of our nuclear forces, which luckily now we think about that.
Right.
Now, whenever the military talks about AI, there's always at least one person that asks them about Skynet. You know, not.
But how many times, besides us doing previous podcasts, you know, trying to, look at yourself objectively as a observer, as an audience member in this film. I know the term objective is very hard because we each have our own individual biases, whether they're positive or negative, or whether they're somewhat, you know, categorically neutral. As looking at yourself as an observer, how many times throughout this film did you look at the robot as a potential killer or as a potential, you know, malfunction thing that's going to hurt something?
We both assumed when I first saw the movie. And you thought it too, and that's why you were kind of appalled what happened later on. When I first saw the movie, I did assume that Ava had a failsafe, that she couldn't kill.
Right.
Just like Asimov's three laws of robotics. We were talking about this in the middle of the movie. I was surprised the first time I saw the movie that Ava and Kyoko used after being completely obedient and subservient to Nathan beforehand, are all of a sudden capable of murder. And it's amazing that he didn't think of that. You were kind of, you know, bashing on him, like, why the hell didn't you put in a failsafe, you dumbass?
Right.
And I have to agree with you. Like, why? I mean, if you're making AI, you have to. I mean, we live in the universe.
Issues the stop command. Like, I don't care if he says, code red. I don't care if he says, like, you know, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. At some point, there is a code word, because we live in this world. This is what I was talking about, where we're life imitating art, imitating life.
Yeah.
Is, we know of the consequences through popular culture, through movie, through literature, through our own imagination, the consequences that can arise by not performing certain functions. And so anybody, let's say Nathan, is involved with creating this artificial intelligence, Ava, to somehow revolutionize human interaction by making a electronic device become sentient in a way, become android, to become human in a way. and he's not going to perform due diligence on his part to make sure that A, doesn't become Skynet, because, you know, you have to suppose that in this world, like we saw in the movie Last Action Hero, you know, you see the character in Last Action Hero who is portrayed by Arnold Schwarzenegger in a blockbuster with the other character in the film, and he sees a Terminator 2 stanchion, but it just happens to be Sylvester Stallone playing the character, because we couldn't have Arnold Schwarzenegger playing the character, because Arnold Schwarzenegger is the detective in the movie Last Action Hero. So my point is that even in a small universe like Last Action Hero, people are aware of everything that we're aware of.
Yeah.
And that's why we laugh at people who are in that world, because...
Or in the horror movies.
In horror movies.
Yeah, it's why did you run upstairs? Why are you going in the basement? What the hell is wrong? Have you not seen any of the movies that everyone else has seen on this planet?
So everybody has. And so when you're creating products, I don't care if you're creating a light switch or you're creating an autonomous artificial intelligence, you've learned from your experience. Unless you've grown up on a rock, you know of the Terminator. You know of Isaac Asimov. And so to not have that is a little disingenuous. It's a little laughable, but it does suppose the end of the story. Obviously, you could have had the story in a different way, and I think that would have made it a little bit more realistic and likable, in my opinion. I didn't mind the fact that she did what she did. I minded how it happened, and with such casualness.
Yeah,
she was so casual with her killing. She was so remorseless that it kind of just let. It was a sped up story that was a little casual with it, but all in all, I loved it. I think that it was smart, could have been smarter, and I hope we do that. I hope if we're actively currently against our best engineers developing artificial intelligence, that we put in kill pills. That's a development term for something that allows us to shut it down remotely. That we program in fail safes like we do with our nuclear weapon facilities, is at least the way that they're portrayed in popular culture, where we have the two keys or the three keys. And, you know, there's just so many ways that we can go about protecting ourselves from ourselves that I think we need
I'm going to do some self-serving kind of thing here about science fiction, is that science fiction in a lot of these movies, not all, but the one of the real great ones that kind of stick with you are the ones that ask questions that have yet to need answers. When Terminator first came out, we were still a good ways off from automating. We're still not automating nuclear weapons. When you mentioned do androids dream of electronic sheep? One of the things, oddly enough, there's a Turing test in that book and in the movie Blade Runner, the Voight Kampff test, where you sit there and interrogate an android. And eventually, there are going to be signals, because they can't. They can simulate, some of the advanced ones can simulate some emotions through micro expressions, but most of them can't go very far. And eventually, you get to see the lack of response to things. That's why Harrison Ford would ask, you know, what if I told you, you know, there was a puppy in a room? Do you like puppies? Like, what if I kicked it, or what if I set the house? And they would, and then he would sit there and examine the responses. That was the Voight Kampff test. Science fiction asked that question in the 70s. That's Philip K. Dick. About androids. This movie is, fast forward a little bit, and the question is no longer whether it's conscious or not, because you almost, like, right away, because Ava can make jokes and Ava has this ability to deceive, which most computers can't do very well, that, okay, she's conscious, but now what? Like, what do we do? Like, is it okay that she's imprisoned? Is it okay that she can be shut down and a new one created? Like, at what point does she have rights as a sentient being?
Right.
And at what point is she culpable? I mean, this is one of the questions I came up with when we were asking this. And that's what the beauty of science fiction is that it forces us to ask ethical questions about things we haven't done yet, but we need to ask ourselves. I mean, we're all worried to death about cloning, even though technically so far we're pretty sure it's possible, but no one's really done it yet. We need to ask,
in terms of humans,
the more technological power we get, the more capabilities we get, it's no longer like we have a new steam-powered engine or we have a new way to make railroads work. These are now powers that are approaching godlike powers.
Yeah.
And you have to have an ethical element, dimension to it. We need to think about what we're doing
and
here.
And fail-safes.
Fail-safes, I mean, that we hold ourselves to, we hold other people to.
Yep.
And we need to look closely, and especially if we do one day become capable of creating AI, like a conscious, sentient being, what responsibilities do we have to it? because we created it. It's basically a child. Or it could be like Ava. Ava was basically a fully formed adult. What responsibilities do we have to it, because we created it, and it is sentient, and what responsibilities do we give it to it? And that's why I would ask, would you say, and I think I already know your answer, that Kyoko and Ava are guilty of murder? Because they murder Nathan at the end of the movie.
Yes, absolutely.
And your answer is yes, and I would have to say yes, too.
Right.
Because there is there's some legal questions later on about false imprisonment, but the basic fact is they didn't have to kill him, they chose to.
Right. They could have subdued him. They could have knocked him out.
And you saw that as, and I guess some people would read this, what she did later on when she escaped the compound and got right. out to the city. And the music kind of suggests this is somehow triumphant.
Right.
And you and I didn't see it as triumphant, but I didn't see it as tragic either that Nathan was killed. I saw it as kind of like a comeuppance. Like you went ahead and built this because you could. Like that's what he admits, that he did it because he could. And you created a sentient being without really taking much responsibility for what it could become. And he ended up creating something that inevitably killed him.
But he did. And I disagree with you there, because he built the series of locks. Now, granted, he put on a key card and the robot who's made out of like machinery with hydraulics could just take from you. He needed to build it a better safeguard.
Yeah, it's failed, safe, failed.
He needs to have like a voice thing where... You know, but then she could impersonate it. So there's a whole series of things. So they just had to get to it, and then they got to it easily with key cards. So it worked with key card. He didn't allow her to leave because, one, he needed to be able to provide an environment that he could find out if she was really sentient, when she was clearly so freaking brilliant that the answer is yes to any, you know, casual observer. But, you know, he did... enforce boundaries. He has this remote location that you can only get to by helicopter. You know, he's got to call up on the phone and be like, okay, helicopter pilot. Now, he did that for Caleb, and she bummed his ride to get out of there. So he did take responsibility. He enforced boundaries that she couldn't go outside. And even if she did, she wouldn't, you know, she wouldn't survive. And that's where I kind of laugh at it, because she makes mentions to her charge paddles or something like that in the film. But when she's leaving to the city, she didn't take anything with her.
She was going to die, yeah. She had a short lifespan. Even if she escaped, she was going to die out there.
She was going to die.
That's the end, yeah. And I guess she was, I guess...
And that's where we're left. So careless with that, the taking Nathan's life, because...
All we can do is assume she didn't care. And she wanted to die on her own. I mean, I'm reaching here.
No, you're right, because she mentioned the charge paddles. If we take what we know from information given to us in the film, she said that the place that she wanted to go and the only place that she wanted to go was an intersection so that she could people watch.
Yes.
And
yes.
You see that in reflections in shadows at the end of the movie, and you see that in one reflection in a window where you can see her on a street. And you know that she went to an intersection where she was with people, and then the shadow disappears, so then you can imagine that was because you realize that she's a robot. She's running on battery power. Anybody who knows who's ever used a cell phone knows they have to charge it. So,
yep.
You know, she's not. They don't ever make mention to nuclear fusion or anything that's running, you know, some superpower inside of her. And they did mention paddles, so you have to assume that she's going to go to her doom. And that's another reason why I was so upset with the carelessness of her taking Nathan's life. Not because I necessarily thought he was a good guy. He wasn't a complete good guy. But I don't think he deserved what he got. Especially mm-hmm. in the way that he got. Like, how am I going to feel if my son kills me? Right?
Yeah,
he kills me in such a chalice way.
And that was the other thing, is that even in a lot of the stories, like throughout history, of all myths and stories, that you see that most of the time, children cannot kill their parents. They can undermine their parents, sabotage them, hurt them.
Right.
But it's very rare you see come across a story where they actually kill their parent. It's almost like a taboo that even the very worst of children can't do. But of course, Ava's not a normal child. And that's why, and it is, it's an appalling end. And you see all of a sudden that she's capable of this. And yeah. And Kyoko is too. But of course, you kind of feel a little bit more compassion for Kyoko because she's treated like shit. And Ava, I mean, they're both treated like shit. But Kyoko, you see a little bit more of it, you know, viscerally, you know, in the way he talks to her. I guess we can go on and on like that. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we wanted to touch on before we check out here.
As we usually do, let me just bring up the errors and omissions. This is a really easy one. We only got one. Android's definition is a robot with a human appearance. That says it's defined. Second to that, going back to Microsoft Matt, it's an open source operating system used for smartphones and tablet computers. I'd recommend Windows.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else I wanted to touch on in terms of science. I guess I'll say this, that this is the best movie, in terms of science fiction, this is the best movie I've seen in a while. So far this year, for me, it's Ex Machina, then Mad Max, and then everyone else is way, way back, because none of them make you think nearly as much as this one. Yeah. All of them, Terminator, Genesis, they all are using the same fears and the same storylines, just repackaged and kind of manipulated. And
yeah,
of course it's fun to watch, it's action, it's, you see the nostalgia, so a lot of other things are going on in these movies, but Ex Machina is something where they try to create an entirely new, not entirely new, I won't say that, but it's basically a story you don't see very often, very unusual, and it makes you think in a different way. It's not Marvel Comics, it's and Mad Max is more of straight just suffering and breaking through the suffering and the despair and the madness of a post-apocalyptic world. And I just have to say that, just in my opinion, Ex Machina is the best I've seen in a while.
Yeah, it was good. I definitely agree with the 4.1 out of 5.
Yeah, and I love that. I hope more of you see it. I know a lot of people did not see it in theaters, but I do notice it's one of the top rented movies on all the streaming sites. All the streaming programs. Ex Machina is one of the top 5 streaming movies that people buy or rent.
You can get it on Xbox Video for $5.99.
Yeah, that's how how you saw it earlier today. I rented it out myself a few weeks ago to see it again. I say all of you should see it. And definitely if you're a science fiction fan and you're a big person into AI, you don't bother with Age of Ultron. Age of Ultron's a comic book movie. If you want to really think about AI and really kind of approach these things, watch this. And I'm just glad they made. I'm glad they finally put it out in theaters more, because originally it only came out in 4 theaters, like LA, New York, and Miami, and that's it. When I was reading that, I'm like, well, when the hell are normal peasants gonna get to see it? And finally, they released it to I think about 1,500 to 2,000 theaters about a month later, and I got to see it at Crossroads, which is a theater down here in Cary, and. I guess, but yeah, that's all I can really say on it. And we also both highly recommend The Imitation Game with Benedict Cumberbatch about Alan Turing. He is one of the most important inventors of our time that some of you may not have even heard of. And when you watch the movie too, it kind of struck a nerve with me, because when I was younger, I'll do this really fast too. We're getting near the end, but when I was younger, I was very awkward and very inept. And I wasn't like a super genius, but I did test very high in some subjects and low in others. And just the struggles he went through, and kind of, he just didn't understand why other people weren't like him.
Yeah.
He didn't understand why people were mad at him. He didn't get it. He's like, I'm trying to tell you the right answer, and you guys are getting mad at me. I don't get it. And he got so frustrated, and he just could not. And it took, I think, Keira Knightley's character to kind of tell him, like, it's one thing to be right. It's another thing to convince other people you're right.
Yeah.
And
sometimes it's not what you said, it's how you say it.
Exactly. And he, in the end, there was something about him that was a little too weird for society. And they forced him to do chemical castration. He ultimately killed himself. And at age 50, I believe. Or late 40s, early 50s.
Died poor.
Imagine if we had Alan Turing for an extra 20 years.
Yep.
Where the hell would we be? But because of the bigoted and just lack of understanding,
social ineptness.
However you feel about gay marriage or anything like that, to criminalize homosexuality, which a lot of countries did back then. I'm not going to bash on Britain. I think a lot of U.S. states, but it just tells you that how many things have we missed out on over human history,
right?
Because we criminalize things that are weird, and we judge people that are not normal,
like the mainstream.
And how many stories do you read about in school and in history of weird people doing extraordinary things?
Amen.
And Alan Turing was one of those people, and his test, which is very relevant to this movie and to everything, the thing we're recording on right now, and the very reason that we can even two idiots talk about movies and share it with everyone all over the internet,
it's because it's Turing complete.
It's because it's Alan fucking Turing. And
right.
So, all right, I'm going to stop there. You got something else you want to add?
Yeah, I'll close out. The reason we can say this is because the computer that we're talking to right now is Turing complete. In short, it can solve any problem that a Turing machine can, which we talked about earlier, given an appropriate algorithm and a necessary time and memory. So if you can completely solve your problems, your complete problems out to zero, given enough time and memory, a computer can be a computer, and then it is referred to as a machine that is Turing complete. So, you know, thanks again, you know, for listening. You know, we talked a lot about, you know, a brilliant British pioneering computer scientists, and we also talked about, you know, things that deal with, you know, technology. And please check out Future of Life Institute. It demonstrates how technology has given life the opportunity to flourish like never before, but also self-destruct. So keep that in mind for you inventors, you listeners out there who want to create something. You know, that's what this film represents. It's the creation of something, but because we are fallible individuals, do we have to take necessary steps to protect ourselves from ourselves? And I think we do. And we learn as individuals, at least if we're growing individuals, I think that we learn from our mistakes so that we are not doomed to repeat them. That's what history gives us. So, you know, just take it for what it's worth, this podcast, as an open letter to yourself to grow, to create, but learn from your experience and to do better moving forward, not just for yourself, but all of humanity. So, futureoflife.org, and, you know, I appreciate you listening, and, you know, we had a really good time checking out Ex Machina. From my opinion, I agree. 4 out of 5 stars.
Absolutely, and... I believe the next podcast will be on the Sad Puppies controversy, which I don't think we're going to do any movie reviews for a while because there's not a lot of sci-fi going on in the month of August. Yeah, I know. It's kind of a downtime. So I think we're going to do some dull ones, maybe do a couple interviews with some indie authors in the next month or so. So stay tuned for that. You guys have a good one. Enjoy your summer vacation. And we will check in later. Goodbye.